What is one surprising fact about the relationship of war and economies that most people probably don't know?
Well, I would say one big thing, given that I've recently given this a lot of thought and I've studied this quite a bit, I would say that we tend to think, based on the work of some political scientists, that violence over time has sort of decreased. There's famous scholars like Steven Pinker who argued that, yeah, maybe we are becoming more civilized in some ways, and there's less violence going on in our societies, especially in the West. But, you know, having recently looked at also long-term trends in this, I don't think that quite holds. So if we look at how many people have died in conflicts and using various metrics, it looks like, in fact, that, you know, we're still quite violent. And if you look at the last 100 years, of course, we have the two world wars as the most deadly conflicts. We're still pretty violent. And in fact, maybe Western countries, to a certain extent, have sort of outsourced some of their wars into the global South. So that's another feature that sort of maybe people don't see as much of the violence. We see it now in Ukraine and Palestine, but oftentimes we don't quite see it.
I thought that as well. I used to think, oh yeah, we've passed this age of mass conflict at a global scale, especially after the two world wars. But like you said, you know, it seems to be happening, like these proxy wars, but they're just not on our doorstep as much. But then, like you said, with Ukraine, maybe that's a reminder of, no, things are still uncertain. There's still a lot of conflict that can happen close to home. So do you think there could be a chance of large-scale global war in Western countries and in Europe in the near future, based off what you've been studying?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I can't rule it out. If you look at different kinds of patterns, people have studied, you know, 100-year cycles and stuff like this, and that kind of work predicts that we, in the 2020s, we would see a great power conflict, particularly between U.S. and China, and I think we're close to that. So it seems like it's possible. And, you know, I think anytime if we sort of look at the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the ongoing war through a kind of a broader lens, we start to see some stuff that's not good for the world as a whole, because it destabilizes Europe. It's caused a kind of a global arms race, which is going to continue for the next 10 to 15 years at least, if not longer. It's also exposed Russian military power to be less effective than we perhaps thought. Yeah. And I've studied the processes that led to the First World War. And there was a similar incident. There was a war between Japan and Russia at that time. And everybody thought at the time that Russia was a great military power, and, you know, they wiped the floor with Japan, sort of upcoming power. And it turned out that Russia lost badly. You know, the naval battles that they engaged in, and Japan had much more modern navy, and it was not even a fair fight. They lost badly. And that led to two things. So first of all, people thought that Russia was not a very effective military power. So they kind of went from thinking they're really big superpower and they're weak and not effective. And sort of the balance kind of perception swings, and that can be dangerous. That feeds arms races, that feeds military competition, and leading potentially to violence. So I can't rule it out. I mean, there's a great deal of tensions in the world with not just between U.S. and China, but if we're thinking of current U.S. foreign policy, that's much more nakedly sort of, let's call it imperialistic in sense of resources around the world, they're doing similar stuff that China has been doing now for quite a while. Yeah. Europeans do it also, but not so publicly. So this is much, much more becoming a kind of a norm in global politics. And I think that's worries me a great deal.
Yeah. And you mentioned a common thread between World War One and then potentially what's happening now with Russia being exposed as not necessarily as powerful as people thought. Are there any other common threads from what you've studied throughout history that often causes a war or has a domino effect that leads to a large-scale conflict? What are some other ones?
Well, I would say in the same context, you know, comparing, you know, situation before the First World War and now, I don't see similar types of, you know, structures in place that will lead to a large-scale conflict. So, because with the First World War, we saw, and yes, we saw an arms race, but we also saw kind of a technological arms race that was particularly worrying. We see some of it now with use of drones, missile technologies, hybrid warfare, electronic warfare. There are some elements there, but it's not quite as pervasive than we saw over 100 years ago. So that's not quite there. But something that is kind of a similarity is that, you know, the First World War was preceded by what we could call a globalization wave. The first one really we saw in the West, and it lasted about 100 years, ever since the end of the Napoleonic Wars, and it lasted until the First War. In fact, people were writing in 1914 that, okay, there's no way we can have a massive war because we're so connected, globalized. We do trade, currencies, all that stuff. And even that European rulers were all related to one another. When, you know, Russian Tsar is writing to, you know, the German Kaiser is, you know, they're writing as, you know, their close family friends. So they thought it couldn't happen, and yet it happened. Something that's worrying, that the more recent globalization wave, which began maybe in the 1960s when we start to see the containerization effect in world trade, it probably came to an end. Economic historians have argued it came to an end probably in 2008 with the financial crisis. But it didn't come to an end like the First World War. So it wasn't that abrupt. It's going to be this slower pattern towards, you know, less growth in global trade and the slowing down. We've seen populism. We've seen this internal political turmoil in many places since 2008. And I think that's something that's, there's a kind of a parallel to in terms of the historical sense that globalization does not prevent or stop conflicts, unfortunately, despite what a lot of people even still today argue that, you know, China and the West are so connected that, you know, no way there can be a war. Yes, there can be a war. We've seen this before. So that's one thing perhaps we can learn from history. I think there are other lessons too. The fact that we've seen arms races before, we sort of know how arms races sort of develop so it's not something that happens very quickly, but then it sort of gathers speed and it's going to be pervasive. You can't really, you know, I wouldn't say that the arms race is going to stop anytime soon. So we're going to see new elements, you know, once hopefully the Russia-Ukraine conflict stops, Russia is going to keep, you know, a certain level of military investments going, higher military spending, because they can't stop it. Their economy, their society is going to collapse if they start turn off the taps and say, hey, we won't do that anymore. So we're going to see elements that keep the arms race going for the next 15 years. So that's unfortunately the future we're facing. Maybe there are parallels from history about the Cold War that we could take to situation now. Are we in already a kind of a Cold War 2.0?
Yeah.
Maybe. There are lessons from history we can learn about, you know, sanctions, that sanctions do not really work. They're fairly ineffective as a policy tool, unless they're accompanied by actual warfare, economic warfare, and you know, troops on the ground and, you know, bombing each other's, all the facilities and so forth. So then it can have a little bit more impact, but sanctions are not a very good tool in terms of stopping wars there. So there are these kinds of lessons that we can learn from history that unfortunately, for some reason, we keep forgetting them. So I don't know why, but people have this sort of fallacy of what I call a kind of distorted view of the reality called this time it's different. So maybe now sanctions will work. Maybe now we will be able to defeat Russia. Maybe now we'll be able to do because something supposedly has changed. But I don't think, you know, things change that dramatically. We can't directly take things from history and say today is the same, but still a lot of the mechanisms I think are the same.
Would you agree that history doesn't repeat itself, but human nature repeats itself.
I would subscribe to that. And I wouldn't say history doesn't repeat itself. There are structures, there are patterns, there are sort of situations that can sort of offer, while they're not entirely the same, they offer us some clues to understand how that works and how the societies are functioning. So that, in that sense, we can also learn from history.
Yeah. And why doesn't globalization, being more interconnected between different countries and different parts of the world, why doesn't that reduce the likelihood of there being conflict and war?
Well, I think it's more wars. If we think of things that sort of, you know, led to the First World War, there are a lot of sort of development there that were not linked to globalization at all. The arms race was not linked to it. The higher military spending, the kind of the naked self-interest of states, they don't change. Oftentimes we think of nation states disappear from history from time to time, but I don't think they do. I think if you look at any sort of integration process, even European integration, a great scholar called Alan Millward talked about the European integration process after Second World War. He described as the European rescue of the nation state. It wasn't that we all of a sudden wanted to work together and do things. Yes, they wanted to avoid a war between France and Germany by all costs, but also it served the interest of the people in those societies. So
yeah,
you know, it farmers got something out of it, the industrial producers got something out of it, and so forth. So the stuff we tend to sort of attribute to the European integration process about freedom of movement and goods within the European Union, that's more of a kind of an afterthought of the whole process.
Mm. And in terms of a future war, future warfare, what do you think that looks like? You mentioned digital and the kind of the cyber side of things. Is the next big war or wars in the future, next century, do you think it will be less direct, or do you think it'll be a mixture of both, whereby there could be cyber attacks, bots on social media trying to influence, you know, opinions and things like that? But do you think there'll always be the death, the chaos, the destruction as a part of that, regardless of where it goes in terms of the cyber stuff online?
Well, I think we've learned from a lot from the war, a lot from of warfare in the last 5 years. Unfortunately, we've seen the two conflicts that we tend to focus the most, which is the fighting in Gaza and then in Ukraine. But there are other conflicts going on too. We see the whole gamut of the type of warfare we've always seen. We see civil wars, which are the most deadly types of conflicts. When society collapses, those are the most bitter type of conflicts and most difficult then to resolve. And of course, the impacts that last after the conflict for decades or centuries are often quite pervasive. So I don't think warfare itself has really changed in Ukraine too. We started out with the notion that warfare is quick and it matters what kind of technology you have, and ultimately it became bogged down in trenches like we saw in the First World War.
Yeah.
So a lot of that hasn't changed. And also the fact that Russian successes really have come from just massive increases in manpower. Mm-hmm. Again, we've seen this before. Really large armies can sort of overwhelm the enemy with the persistence if you take your time and you're willing to overlook casualties. So those elements haven't changed. So I would say the hybrid warfare, electronic warfare, new technologies, drones, etc., they're bringing some new sort of elements to this mix that do change the fact of what it's like to fight in the battlefield. But people dying in trenches in Ukraine, they're dying regardless if it's a drone dropping a explosive on their heads, or if it's artillery. And in fact, we don't talk about as much in the Ukrainian context. It's the fact it's still artillery, it's still mortars, it's still fairly sort of traditional type of destructive sort of technology that is effective in this battle. And the fact that you know, we have seen over centuries, we've seen this increase, what we would call a bang for the buck. So how much you spend, how much destructive power you have, how many people you're able to kill with that investment. That unfortunately has been increasing. Of course, it's hard to estimate it, you know, very directly because, you know, the nuclear weapons have changed the game in that. But we of course, our idea is that we don't use those, even though they have the most destructive capacity. But so they have created a little bit of a difficulty in our assessment of that. But overall, technology has become more deadly and more cost effective to produce. And we've seen this in the last century, especially since the Industrial Revolution, that we have this capacity to mass create this type of weaponry, and it is very effective, and you kill people more effectively with these technologies. And that, to me, is going to accelerate even further now with drone technologies, missile technologies, unmanned types of different kinds of drones and fighters and so forth. AI, robotics, all those kinds of things are just going to increase this bang for the buck. And unfortunately, we will see that play out in future conflicts. But if they're short conflicts, yes, they're more sort of focused on these aspects. But if they become protracted conflicts, they become more like what we've used to see even in the First World War, people fighting in trenches and dying there massively. And we've seen bombardments of cities and still, you know, stuff like that, that, you know, Russia, for example, is pretty much indiscriminately bombing Ukrainian cities and communities with the idea that somehow that's going to break their will to fight. That has really never worked either. So, hopefully they're doing it out of ignorance, but I fear they're probably doing it on purpose. They just want to cause destruction, regardless of whether it advances their war goals in this war.
So it's still fundamentally a war of attrition, just with some slightly new technologies like drones that are now part of that.
Yeah, I would say so. And we've seen also, you know, the fighting in other conflicts that tends to be, it's less technologically intensive. It's still, you know, it depends which countries and are fighting one another. And if it's more of an asymmetric type of warfare, which we've seen in the most brutal way in Gaza, one country that has particularly advanced weaponry and capacity just keeps bombarding the other side that is fighting very much an asymmetric type of warfare with you know, terrorism and other similar types of means. And it's just a conflict that it's hard to see what the you know, what's going on there right now because of the there's limited access to the battlefield, but overall we see that kind of warfare. That's also can be typical, but as we know from history, and Israelis should know this too, is that, you know, with this kind of strategies, not only have they created a massive backlash globally against Israelis and Jews, but they've created, you know, whole boatload of future terrorists because of people who are suffering through these attacks, regardless what Hamas or Hezbollah or any of these organizations do.
And in terms of nuclear bombs and nuclear power, has there ever been a technology and innovation like that in history where this new thing's arrived and it's just had such a big impact on warfare and how wars are potentially started or not started? Has that ever happened at such a scale, or has there been any similarities in history before to the nuclear bomb?
Not probably anything of that scale.
Yeah.
I haven't seen weaponry that would be that decisive in stopping a conflict or killing people at that scale. But one of my favorite examples of when we look at it did stop the Second World War. And I think, you know, although there's been a great deal of debate among, you know, scholars whether it was necessary to drop the atomic bombs on Japan, which is a horrific act. And we've seen the pictures of what happens to people I think the evidence is still there that Japan would have resisted for a longer time.
Yeah.
It would have been a massive military manpower cost for the Allies to finally subdue Japan. It probably would have cost a great deal more damage to Japan and on the Japanese side, cities and so forth. So to a certain extent, I can understand that it made sense and it not necessarily to drop two bombs, but at least one to showcase the new weapon. But we also tend to lose sight that if we look at the Allied side did to Germany and Japan, they dropped sometimes in one night enough firebombs to burn down entire cities. What we saw in Dresden, for example.
Yeah, Dresden. Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's one famous example of and when we saw this in many cities in Japan during the war, they killed more than 100,000 in one night, which are similar numbers when we look at Hiroshima or Nagasaki. And Dresden is, you know, one example of that, where they drop firebombs in a very conscious way, by the way. So they knew what they were doing. They drop on the outskirts of the city, which causes massive fire that draws inwards. First of all, it burns people to death, and then it sucks out all the oxygen. So to me, that's a similar level of killing. But it's not the same one weapon that can do it. It's a coordinated attack. Mm-hmm. So we haven't seen that level of sort of increase in the ability to kill people with certain types of technology before or since. Of course, nuclear weapons were refined and their killing power increased during the Cold War a lot. But, you know, we've seen, you know, big sort of jumps in military technology that changes the way people fight wars, or that changed the way that, you know, countries compete against one another in terms of military supremacy. For example, if we look at the situation before the First World War, you know, the invention of the dreadnought, a new type of battleship, is a good example of that, where you all of a sudden have a new technology, new type of ship that's completely superior to everything else at that time. So, everybody had to start building dreadnoughts. That changes the game. Germans, of course, they invest heavily in submarines and then submarine warfare to try to counter this, because they couldn't compete with the Brits in terms of the dreadnoughts and the Navy in general. So that changes the dynamic. Or if we go further back in time, the Byzantine Empire, for example, they were very dependent on the Greek fire, for example. That technology was particularly deadly and effective on the battlefield, especially in their naval warfare when they used this. Or if you look at, you know, if you look at some of the Chinese dynasties, the Sung dynasty and the Qin, Ming and the Qin dynasties, they do massive sort of advances in military technology in terms of what kind of navies they had and missile technology, et cetera, that were way ahead of their time. So all those were effective in their own way in terms of determining how they competed with one another.
Wait, hold that thought. I'm genuinely so grateful that you've stuck around with us to listen to these fascinating insights from the guest so far. If this episode has given you one piece of knowledge which has helped you understand yourself and the world a little bit better than before, the absolute best way to support us is to pay it forward and hit the share button right now. Don't let this knowledge stay hidden. Please send it to one person who will benefit from this episode. Thank you so much. Let's dive back into the rest of the episode.
Yeah, could you tell me a bit more about the Greek fire? Because I've read that before, but I'm not sure what that is. What type of warfare and strategy did that entail, and how was it used in navies in the Byzantine Empire?
So the Greek fire was essentially it was this sort of mixture of chemicals that kind of I don't think we still haven't quite cracked the secret of what it contained, but naphtha and different kinds of chemicals that made it so that a mixture that when you set it on fire, so for example, if you got this substance on you and you jumped into the water, it didn't put out the flame. It didn't put out the flames of the fire. So it's that kind of substance. So it's very difficult to do anything about it. And what the Byzantine soldiers did, they had these kind of like hand cannons that they would shoot almost like a hose. They would shoot the stuff. So they get close enough to the enemy ship. They shoot the stuff. The whole ship will burn. Everybody will burn on it. So it was very effective, kind of a napalm of its day. And this technology, it made them very feared and effective on the battlefield. And of course, they guarded this type of technology. It was a death penalty would be applied if you tried to smuggle this technology or knowledge of it outside the Byzantine Empire. So they were able to keep it secret for a long time. That gave them an edge. Byzantine Empire did eventually end because they were then in the 15th century, they were finally, they faced the Ottomans who had embraced the gunpowder technology and new cannons and stuff that were able to break the walls of Constantinople and ultimately the city was conquered. But they lasted for a long time partially because of this technology.
Yeah. And did you say it's still a secret now what was actually in it?
Yes. I mean, historians have, I think they've been able to sort of recreate mostly what it is, or at least similar effect. But I don't think we've seen there's no, archival document says, okay, here's what you put in and to achieve. So it was closely guarded secret recipe that only the certain people in the Byzantine Empire would know how it was manufactured.
And is this a common thread? Is having some sort of new innovative technology, is that something that can increase the chances of an economy in war prospering and staying that way until, like you said, for example, the Ottomans, they found a new way to catch up? Right. Is that a common thread that you've seen throughout history?
Well, yes. I mean, we'd have to define what a technology is, because we can go to the, we can think of the Macedonians and, Alexander the Great, what made them so effective, the phalanx, the formation that they used was pretty effective. When Alexander was facing with the Persians, oftentimes he would use tactics that others would not use at any battlefield situation. So it seemed reckless, and the Persians were not expecting it. So they weren't facing it. And of course, Alexander was also able to sort of adjust his tactics and use of elephants and stuff like that once they went further east. But they didn't quite get to China, for example, because I think they would have fared very poorly if they had, entered China. And because Chinese already, 300-400 BC, they had experimented with everything, different kinds of militias. They had tried different kinds of formations. They knew, this is the art of war, which was this knowledge base that was supplemented over centuries. And so the Chinese would have looked at the Macedonian phalanx and they would have been sort of amused. Okay, that's what you're doing. Here's how we counter it. And they would have completely defeated Alexander. So there are sort of military technologies, military strategic thinking that's also important in terms of being able to be dominant on the battlefield. So, because if we look at the Mongols, for example, it is the fact that they relied on this really aggressive type of warfare that used horses and horseback and sort of surprise attacks, blitz attacks that tended to take their enemies by surprise. And of course, being extremely brutal, and that would sort of crumble the resistance to their attacks.
Could you say the same about modern China now if a country was to try and invade them? Or do you think that doesn't hold in time now? You said about how Alexander wouldn't have fared well because the Chinese had tried so many different things. Do you think that's still the case?
Well, I think it up to a point, yes. Of course, today's China is a more centrally led authoritarian nation. So it, I think those nations don't necessarily always promote the best talent to the top positions in the middle military leadership. So that probably would be somewhat of a hindrance. But of course, there is this millennia-long, you know, knowledge base that they've cultivated in terms of strategic thinking and so forth. So and I think that's still present in China today. They would be extremely well prepared, and I've read some stuff about China. They're well prepared for, you know, global upheaval and potential conflicts, and people have prepared for maybe an upcoming conflict, that they're ready for it. They're ready to make sacrifices. There's this more collective type of thinking mentality that Chinese are more ready to accept than most countries in the West. So it you know, of course, it's harder than to say how that would benefit or not benefit them in terms of conflict with the U.S. But Chinese technologies, they've gotten much better, and they are competing, even global arms sales and arms markets, they're competing with the Western producers up to a certain extent already. And now that Russian technology has been shown to be less effective, I think China is becoming more attractive as a source of sort of non-Western alternatives to some military technology. So that's also going to be an advantage for the Chinese.
Hmm. And if there is one, what do you think is the greatest threat to Western civilization or civilization as a whole? If there's anything in particular, it doesn't have to be a country or a weapon, but it can be. What do you think?
Yeah, I wouldn't say necessarily a country, or I mean, I think most the Western countries are in many cases they are kind of adrift ever since this waning of the globalization wave and the financial crisis, and that the kind of populist challenges within divisions within those are the biggest threats to Western societies. So whenever they sort of become more and more divided internally, like we're seeing in the United States, those processes to me are the most worrying, and can lead to some sort of inner turmoil or even global turmoil. And we've seen this year with the U.S. policies changing and causing a lot of uncertainty, because that weakens, for example, NATO as an alliance when you don't see quite eye to eye, when you don't have the common goals, or they're, you know, you don't agree necessarily what the alliance is supposed to do. But, you know, it's, you know, brought some quote unquote positives too, in terms of Europeans, for example, have finally been forced to come together and think about potential joint European defense arrangements, whether it's a European NATO or EU-led something or whatever, but it does feature two nuclear powers with Great Britain and France as being kind of the backbones of it. That's been kind of the post Second World War arrangement. You need to have the nuclear deterrence as the ultimate deterrence to have credibility, to reduce at least the potential for these smaller skirmishes to explode into a full blown war, because that's kind of the lesson of the Cold War. It may lead to some smaller proxy wars and borders and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, that's still better than a full-scale war between large entities like the EU and Russia, for example.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And are there any historical examples where the winning side's economy has actually ended up worse than the losing side after a war?
Well, I don't necessarily think that the winning side didn't fare okay after the Second World War. But in fact, a lot of the countries that lost the Second World War, if we think of Germany, Japan, to a certain extent, Italy, they do quite well after the Second World War.
Yeah.
After they are able to sort of come to some sort of reckoning, because after the First World War, there was no real decisive sort of arrangement that said these countries, you know, the militarism would be stopped. So there was that element after the Second World War. There's more decisive sort of agreement, and then also global arrangements that you make collaboration and sort of sharing of technologies, et cetera, much more easier with the Marshall Plan and those kinds of interventions. So, I mean, the German, Japanese economies to develop really, really favorably. I'm talking West Germany in 1950s, 1960s. So in fact, which is kind of strange, the height of the Cold War, 50s and 60s, the world as a whole saw probably the fastest economic growth we've ever seen. And we're talking in the case of Japan and Germany, we're talking growth rates of, you know, 7 or 8% per year. So, which is, you know, not really feasible in sort of more mature Western economies. But that's really unprecedented. So, I would say in that case, the losing countries actually did fairly well, at least in comparison with the winners.
That's a good example. And how did West Germany and East Germany compare in terms of economic growth over the Cold War? I know there was a big difference, but how big was the difference?
Well, I think the jury is a little bit out still on the actual figures for East Germany, how did they fare and so forth. But at least the evidence that I've seen, it's very modest economic growth. There are some, you know, years when it's a little bit stronger and so forth. But I mean, the West Germany, the economic growth is much, much faster. Living standards rise much faster. They recover from the Second World War much faster.
Yeah.
And of course, the Soviet sort of policy towards its satellite states was this kind of brutalized industrialization that wasn't always the best strategy, and it state-led kind of control of the economy was not great in terms of innovations and so forth. So, I mean, the gap was pretty big when we get to the German unification at the end of the 1980s. So, and unfortunately, the gap somewhat still persists today, even German unified. So if you look at where's the strongest support for the far right political parties, it's in almost exclusively in eastern part of Germany, who felt that they've kind of been left behind. So that kind of situation would be analogous to what we might see if there's a settlement between Russia and Ukraine, and Ukraine gives up its eastern part to Russia. I think we would see similar development. Western part of Ukraine would develop, you know, very fast. There's going to be a lot of Western investments, some sort of Marshall Plan type of reconstruction, whereas the eastern part, the Russians probably don't have the resources or the interest really to do much else. Make sure there's some sort of corridors to send people and supplies to Crimea. And I think that over decades, it would develop into an East Germany, West Germany kind of situation. So if they eventually unify, they would have a hard time making that work.
Do you think that could likely happen? Do you think part of Eastern Ukraine will end up being under Russia in the near future? Or do you think Ukraine will try and stick with it for as long as possible?
Well, unfortunately, I think, even Trump said last summer, was that I think all parties more or less know what the agreement could or should be. And unfortunately, Ukrainians will likely have to cede that territory, Eastern Ukraine, for Donbass and so forth. So, and I know it's probably a very difficult issue in Ukraine and talk about publicly giving up your territory is always very difficult. But I think it's more or less the military reality on the field. Russian side too, I mean, they don't know that they're not going to gain all that much territory with this strategy. It's too slow. It's too painful. So eventually they'll have to make that calculation. And the Ukrainian strikes to, you know, Russian infrastructure is actually quite clever because it's creating some pressure, popular pressure on the government. Eventually, if gas prices are really high, if railways don't work, if the water systems and sewage doesn't work, all those things will make the war very clear to the Russian citizens that this is not just small special operations that the government censorship can hide. So that will be something that will make potentially the war so unattractive to Russia that they'll have to make that deal. I think we've sort of skirted with that arrangement, and I think Zelensky and the Ukrainians are probably, to a certain extent, they're ready for that kind of deal. And I'm sure it would mean that Zelensky personally would probably have to agree on this deal and try to get it through the parliament. And then he would have to resign. He would incur the political cost of that. And his political future would be probably over, at least in the near future. And probably later generations will recognize this as a necessary sacrifice. But
yeah,
this what the Finnish prime minister, for example, did in 1944, when Finland was close to collapsing under the Soviet sort of renewed push in the summer of 1944. And the prime minister had to make a deal with the Germans, who were kind of withdrawing and having their own issues, but they wanted to exact some promises from the Finns in exchange for some new weaponry and things that would help them at the front in a critical time. So the prime minister and the government decided on this, and then ultimately it was the president who took the blame for then signing this, and then he was in fact convicted of this in the war crimes tribunal after the fact. But he kind of took it on upon himself that, okay, I'm going to sign it, I'm going to take the blame once we have to sort of break away from the Germans in the near future anyway.
So did the Germans end up going to defend Finland because of that policy?
Well, they did help them somewhat in the northern part of Finland, but ultimately it was more the material help, the tanks, the artillery and weaponry that the Finns needed to be able to stop the Soviet push that summer. And that was in fact quite crucial. But they were forced to conclude an unfavorable peace deal in the fall of 1944, and ultimately even pushed the Germans out of northern Finland, in an actual last stage of the war, because of the peace treaty that they had to sign.
I really, really liked reading about the first wave when the Soviets tried to attack Finland, and you guys were like completely outnumbered, and you were just like, there were like soldiers in like skis on, like doing stealth attacks. Like I really like World War II, and it took me 19 or 20 years to even know that even happened. Have you studied that period of the war where Finland pushed the Soviets back?
Well, I have studied a little bit. And part of that, the strategy would be, it worked the best in kind of middle and northern parts of the country and the border with the Soviet Union, because there were fewer roads, harsher conditions during wintertime. Basically, the strategy was so that, the Soviets tried to use the roads to move their equipment and heavy equipment and personnel. And by the way, a lot of the Soviet personnel came from southern parts of Soviet Union, so they were not really ready or equipped for the harsh Finnish winter. For example, the winter of 1939-1940 was particularly cold, and so they were not ready for it. But what the Finns did was that they figured, okay, we have fewer troops, we're going to use the geography to our advantage. So, for example, they would shut or cut off the roads at different intervals behind and in front of the advancing Russian troops, and then they would start hammering them from the forests and especially during the dark hours, which during the wintertime in Finland are quite long. So they would keep at it. So they have nowhere really to go. They don't see them. They're attacking, yes, on skis from the forest. So that tended to lead to massive sort of surrender of Russian troops and kind of big defeats initially in the war. But even that war, the more it progressed, the more manpower the Soviets brought to the so-called Winter War, especially in February and March of 1940. Okay, things were not looking so great for Finland. In fact, the only thing that saved them, and they were able to conclude a peace treaty in which they lost some land, was because the Western powers like the UK and Germany, UK and France, they were threatening that they potentially could intervene on the part of Finland. So, you know, it may start, you may start with some successes, that new strategies, new technologies, but ultimately it turned into a fairly traditional attrition war that was not in favorable to the Finns.
And being so close to Russia now, and I mean, this was quite a while ago, but I did read that, saw images of developments on the border between Finland and Russia. This was quite a while ago. I don't know what's changed in the last decade or so. Is the tensions increased since the Ukraine war between Finland and Russia?
Well, in a kind of a tragic way, yes, the tensions in general have increased, and Russia views Finland now as a hostile nation, as a part of the NATO. But you know, how much of that is rhetoric and how much they actually consider that, because Finland doesn't really have much that the Russians really would want.
Yeah,
there's, you know, not an abundance of minerals or stuff like that that would be advantageous to them. Of Finland has a large standing army and really large reserve and a lot of Western technology, and now we're part of NATO. So it's not a very attractive target for Russia. But the war in Ukraine, they've had to withdraw a lot of their military assets from the border to fight in Ukraine. And they've, in fact, some of the divisions, they've incurred horrific losses. So they've been decimated. So I would say that troops that are stationed near the Finnish-Russia border, they're inexperienced. They're not very effective. There's a lack of technologies there to sort of produce a really credible, you know, existential threat to Finland. Mm. But that doesn't mean, of course, Russians would, once if the war ended, they would probably, you know, they would strategically think of where to put these larger army that they're likely to keep to a certain extent anyway after the conflict, that they would have to station some of them on the Finnish border. But I think to Russia, in fact, it would be much more for their long-term strategic goals, it would be more important for them to sort of put a larger presence in the Arctic and northern part of Finland to be able to maintain that role in the Arctic. And so I would expect them to, in the near future, to expand that role and their military presence there. But I would say it, and this is kind of different from what of my colleagues or friends in Eastern European countries feel. They feel the Russian threat is very acutely and rightfully so. But here, I think we have a fairly confident but cautious attitude towards the Russian threat, that yes, we know it's there, it's likely to increase in the future, but I think we're pretty confident in our own abilities as well.
Yeah, and how big is your army then? You said you have quite a large army in reserves as well. Do you know the numbers?
I think if we count the entire reserve, active reserve, we're talking like 800,000 men,
wow,
women. So it's potentially that could be expanded in a wartime situation. I don't know offhand the actual size of the standing army today. It's also hard because we have a career military and we have a conscription army. Also, all males have to serve in the army unless they're exempted. And for women, it's voluntary. But there's a great number of women who also go through the military service all the time. So that also changes a bit in terms of what size of a cohort they have in the military. But I think it's fair to say that Finland easily would have a standing army close to 100,000 that could be quickly mobilized, and a larger reserve than overall that's fairly well trained. Some of them, of course, would be older, but anyway would be a credible to different aspects of any conflict.
Mm. And how has Finland's economy changed throughout history? What has made it prosperous throughout history compared to today?
Well, Finland in the past had, you know, 150 years ago was a very agrarian country. So it's dominated by agriculture and hunting. But it's become a much more modern country. So in the 20th century, Finland caught up to the Nordic countries and the Western countries. So it has a very similar trajectory. There was a shorter industrial revolution, but fairly quickly from the 1960s onwards, Finland became much more dominated by the service sector. different aspects of the service sector. So Finland and Sweden and these countries went more quickly in that direction than other Western countries have gone as well. So I'd say it's now a very high living standards society, and with high levels of education and high tech society, I would say. And it's also a society, as you've seen in some of the, you know, some of the indicators where people say the Finland's, or the indicators indicate that Finland is the happiest country in the world 7 years in a row. It's not so much that people are just smiling and happy all the time. It's more so that people here are pretty happy with the society as a whole. Their own enclaves, groups of people. They trust the government to a great deal. They trust that, you know, we can't be invaded very easily. We trust that, you know, the social security that's strong enough to withstand, you know, major crises and stuff like that. That those are things that make Finland fairly functional. And economy has been kind of rough ever since the, I would say, the financial crisis. Finland's economy has been in a kind of a rut, very slow growth or almost zero growth. And we did okay with the COVID crisis. But since then, our economy has been kind of stalled. And right now, there's a big societal debate about fairly high unemployment, over 10%. And in fact, in Europe, within the EU, we're the second highest after Spain.
Wow.
So the unemployment is pretty persistent. But, you know, we've had these issues of kind of the current government has perhaps sort of made this situation a bit worse because they've been very focused on the government debt. Or public debt, and they tried to make cuts to Social Security and other such things that perhaps spooked people a little bit from spending. Mm. And of course the Russia-Ukraine war with, you know, no more Russians tourists or trade, that has impacted particularly Eastern Finland. All those factors and the recent crisis have kind of hit our economy pretty hard. And Finland's economy has always been very globally oriented. So whenever there's turmoil globally, I think we feel it very strongly, maybe more strongly than some other European countries would.
Hmm. And you said that Finland is, from the indicators, is one of the happiest, or the happiest country in the world. And from when I've been studying geography, it's always super high on the development scores, the HDIs, all of that stuff. What can Western countries or any country learn from Finland and the Nordic countries in terms of that side of things, the living standards, the development, and what strategies have Finland done to enable that for such a long period of time since the Second World War?
Yeah. Well, it's something. It would be nice if I could say, you know, to decision makers, here's the formula, here's what and it's not that you can say, oh, you just need to do implement more inclusive democracy or something like that. It's not that. I think in the case of these countries, there's something fundamentally there that's enabled that we have had all for centuries high scores in terms of trust in society, partially that small countries and fairly homogeneous countries and populations that has helped certainly. But there's elements here that have, I think, trust in societies has been high for a long time. That's one component of it.
Hmm.
Welfare states in the Nordic countries have required some sort of compromise between political parties. Hey, this is what we need to do. Otherwise, we're going to have a lot of strikes and societal unrest. This is a better way to do it. And it requires some sacrifice, higher taxation, and people have to pay their fair share. So those are components of that equation. So unfortunately, it takes a long time. So in Finland too, there's been decades and decades of debates, what we need to do, trying this and that. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And for example, Finland scored really high on the PISA scores in terms of having really highly performing students. But it's not permanent. I mean, in the decades afterwards, Finland's PISA scores have declined. Wow. And they've tried to implement reforms. They haven't been so successful. So sometimes things work for a while and then they don't work so well, and you have to sort of experiment. But ultimately, I think it comes down to trust in society, that you have people trust the government, the system, the society around them, and that makes it a functional. It's something that's very hard to reproduce. It's very hard to manufacture. It takes a long time to develop, sometimes, I mean, Finland had a civil war in 1918, so it's not that long ago. It's 100 years, but still. Second World War, they were already fairly united, but it's taken that decades and decades of building up that trust and society, and that has enabled the societies to become more coherent and well-functioning.
Mm. And where do you think it came from? Because it's not just Finland, from what I've read, that has that ethos. It's also some of the other Scandinavian Nordic countries. How come it's concentrated in this one area of the world?
It's hard to say. I think part of the equation is the fact that they're societies that, you know, fairly, you know, ethnically or otherwise were fairly sort of unified, and there was a shared set of values. There was a role of different organizations in the society, church and state and so forth, that worked together. And all those things sort of have enabled it, but it's very hard to explain. I don't think social scientists have a good handle on. Sometimes they talk about social capital or some sort of concepts like this that would try to get a handle on it, but I think we don't have a really good sense of it. I would put it this way, like the recent Nobel Prize winners, Acemoglu, Johnson and Robinson, who are institutional economists, they said that it's more so, a lot of things in history are really, they're hard to change. They have long-term impacts. So, you know, things that, you know, colonialism has impacts for hundreds of years, negative ones. And civil wars have impacts, negative influences for a long time. So it's kind of, when you get on that right track, it's also something that can be reinforced and slowly built up, and then you build on it. So it's not so much about what they call formal institutions like laws and constitutions. It's more so when you build trust and you know, shared values, et cetera, in society. And sometimes that can't be, you know, manufactured by a government or anything like that. There has to be a right set of circumstances that enable that. But I don't think we have a good handle, but it's this informal institutions that were, I think, is the key to understanding it. And societies like Finland, the gap between how people think we should behave and the actual laws is fairly small. But societies where those are far apart, we see corruption, we see conflict, people don't accept the society the way it functions, they can be revolutions and so forth. So it's harder for me to explain where it comes from, but just observing, I think that's kind of one of the key mechanisms.
Yeah, no, well said, very well said. And few ending questions, slightly more philosophical, I guess. Do you believe in God?
I do.
Yeah.
Let me augment that in a sense that I do believe in a God or some type of, you know, sort of similar type of structure that we simply do not understand. I'm much more skeptical towards organized religion and, you know, whatever different religions might say about some sort of supreme being or whether. I put it this way also to my students in the past. You know, we can point to historical evidence that potentially or most likely there was a person that we later have called Jesus that lived the time of the Roman Empire. But, you know, we can't really verify or, you know, prove conclusively that this person was the Son of God and so forth. So there's sort of historians' view on, you know, what may have happened, and then somewhere we get more into the philosophical or theological discussion, then it's a matter of faith.
Yeah, because even if the historical side of things in terms of Jesus being the Son of God and all of the stories from the Bible and stuff, even if they're false, it doesn't necessarily or at all mean that there isn't a higher being still, regardless of that, right?
Right, correct. Yeah. That's a good way of putting it.
And what is the meaning of your life? You know, if you can summarize it, what's your moral compass? How do you see that?
I would define as some of my foundational moral principles as as something that I've learned over my lifetime, I would say it's a matter of being kind to other humans, being kind to animals. I think that would be a very sort of foundational thing that I've learned to or become much more attuned with. I would say also I have a great deal of respect and admiration towards democracy and democratic structures in general, freedom of speech, those sort of larger sort of principles. And I would say in terms of my own meaning of my life, it's hard for me to say except that I like very much what I do as an educator. So that to me is one of the foundational things that I'm able to sort of impart my small bits of wisdom to other human beings who may take it and run with it. So I'll put it this way, that my greatest sort of triumphs, especially professionally, happen whenever some of my students succeed. They have some sort of milestone that they celebrate. They get their doctorate, or they get some sort of award or a new job or something. Those are the moments that are the most meaningful for me.
Yeah, very well said. And having that positive impact, I guess, on others around you and helping them.
Yeah, I would say so, yes.
And do you think aliens exist, or do you think we're the only ones out there?
I'm not arrogant to think that they don't exist. I just don't know if they've made it to our planet. I think it's just mathematically probable they do exist. And we're just, I think my way of looking at, we are just basically, we're ants on this globe. And we think we know a lot when we know actually very little. And in fact, it's likely that that there are a lot of other much smarter civilizations that probably are observing us.
Yeah.
And they're mostly thinking that we're not worth the visit. Fortunately, like, you know, Stephen Hawking said, you know, likely if that visit ever comes, it's not going to be a very positive one. It's going to be one that they're coming here to conquer us. So we'll end up being colonized or become food. So hopefully, I'm not hoping for that encounter anytime soon.
Yeah, hopefully we're like a really poisonous mushroom in a forest that everyone avoids.
Yes, we're so belligerent and difficult that they don't want to deal with us.
Yeah, they're looking at us and like, why do they keep doing the same stuff over and over again with these wars?
They don't learn anything. They don't learn any of these.
I like the idea of it being us, Earth being like a national park where like they just let us get on with it and they can't touch us. Then we need to keep it pristine and just let the ants get on with whatever they're doing. We need to just leave them alone. Hopefully that's the case, right?
Let's hope so.
Yeah. And if you could give your 20-year-old self one piece of advice, what would it be and why?
Well, I would probably say, in fact, you know, in my 20s, for example, I was probably a bit more arrogant as a sort of student and then later an aspiring academic. You know, I remember telling one of my colleagues, for example, at a conference that, you know, he said, hey, we should go to talk to this person. I said, no. That's not worth my time. You know, he's not important enough or something like that.
Yeah.
And I would tell I probably smack my 20-year-old self, say that, come on, you do better.
Yeah.
That you never know human encounters. They can bring such joy or new insights. And you learn from your students, you learn from other people and situations. And I've come into situations sometimes by accident where I've gain something really important and just being open to those ideas. So just, you know, be kind and be open to new ideas. I would say that to my 20-year-old version.
Very good advice, Yari. And why did that change? Was it just from experience?
I think it's from experience and learning and being an educator. The more I've interacted with people, I've learned to be much more open to new ideas and of course being much less arrogant about my own abilities and learning my limitations. And I think that's been extremely humbling and good learning experience. And some of the best academics that I've worked with, that I've met, have been, you know, they've been the same way. And I've learned from those examples that, oh, wow, that's brilliant. That's inspiring. And I learned, okay, that's what you got to do. And then you can pass it forward when you teaching others. And I found that to be very, very fulfilling also personally.
Yeah, it's just stay curious and, you know, be open to anything from anyone in terms of wisdom. You know, you never know who you can learn from, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Yari Elaranta, ladies and gentlemen. Yari, really appreciate this. This was a really good conversation and you've helped me understand a lot more about conflict throughout history, but also today, because I try to avoid the news quite a lot. So thank you for sharing your wisdom on that with me. And what are you currently working on?
Well, I'm working on similar topics. I'm working on sanctions, economic warfare in general. I'm working I'm thinking of writing a book about kind of economics of war, and those sort of topics. They still occupy my sort of mindset a great deal even today.
Awesome. And where can people go if they want to find your work?
Well, for example, I've got a new book out on Routledge, came out in May, The Routledge Economic History of War. So people who are interested in this topic, I think they'll find a lot of interesting stuff in that book.
Awesome. Yeah, I'll leave the links to that in the show notes below. I really appreciate you and thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Awesome. If you've made it this far, you're likely not just a listener, you're ready to be the host. You felt that sense of intimacy and connection with our guest today, and you would like to get the same on your own show and start your own dream show. But you're worried about landing dream guests and all the complications and the mess that is often spoken about when starting your own podcast from scratch. You think starting a podcast requires a huge budget and a whole team, right? That is absolute nonsense. My Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint is the ultimate key to skipping the outdated advice and building a high quality, high impact show, even for under $100. It provides the proven strategies and AI templates that I use this day that you will be able to use to reclaim your time and creative control. And this is a strictly limited opportunity. Don't dilly-dally because there's limited spaces. We've already got one student, Rob, who's joined. That means there's only a couple more spaces to get the Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint course half price. And you need to act very, very fast because this is a limited offer and you're very, very early. So if you want to get the early bird discount like Rob has and get the results by watching the course that goes through the exact step-by-step blueprint that I use to this day to create these episodes that you've just watched and get the success and become Europe's fastest growing under 21 podcaster, and also join live weekly calls with me and use the AI templates and email templates that I use every single day to get the results and just get all my secrets without getting any of the mistakes and failures that I've made, then top link in the description is for you. And if you're ready to launch your own show and get personalized one-to-one help from me and copy my blueprint, which no other podcaster has shared, then I'll see you there. I'm rooting for you. Goodbye. Hope you enjoyed the episode too.